Okay, good afternoon, everybody. There is always more to learn, also about SQL Server, but this talk will not be about what is new in SQL Server. If you're interested in that, I'm afraid you're about half a day late. This morning, Dirk Heubels had a talk about new features in SQL Server 2008 R2. This talk is about things that SQL Server sometimes does different from what most people expect. My name is Nico Jacobs. I'm a trainer at UTU, and over there we often notice that in our sessions, our courses on SQL Server, even on the advanced courses, sometimes people struggle with concepts of SQL Server, which are not new at all, but which are in there for already many years. So what we will see in this session are five topics, five areas, where sometimes people get different results from what SQL Server is offering them, different from what they expected. So what I want to do is, on each of those five topics, I first want to do a very brief demo of typical things you might see happening on your SQL Server. And then I'll show you how you can inspect what is really happening behind the scene and how you can solve the problem. So these are the five topics that we have on our agenda. Quite a lot, so let's immediately get started with the first point of attention. That's transactions. This morning in the developer keynote, they talked about isolation. They talked about that nowadays .NET developers start to worry about running code in parallel. But well, since you're all into SQL Server, you're all used to running code in parallel. On our SQL Server, on databases in general, already during nearly 30 years, we now have stored procedures running in parallel. We have race conditions all the time. While you're trying to insert a new record in that table, some other piece of code is reading from that table. So we need to make sure that what is happening is happened in an isolated environment. That we, while we are, for instance, changing a table, are not disturbed by what other people are doing at the same time on that table. So most developers then know that transactions are the way out. So transactions give us a bunch of properties. Atomicity, everything we run runs as if it was one single statement. Consistency, we always leave the database in a consistent state. Isolation, we are isolated from what is happening by other users. And durability, if the power goes down and comes back up again, everything that was committed remains committed. Well, let's go and have a look at this, because we will see that it's not always what people are expecting. Okay, most of the code that I run over here, I run in Management Studio. In reality, you'll probably be throwing this into a .NET application or whatever, but simply to keep things simple, I just go ahead and run my statements in Management Studio. I'm using a 2008 over here, but everything I'll show you works on a 2005 as well. And some of the things are even the same on a 2000. So it doesn't really matter which SQL Server you're using. Most of these things are the same everywhere. You don't need to write down any code if it interests you. I'll place this stuff at the UTU blog. So the only thing you have to write down is that URL over there, http://blogs.utu.be/utu. So let's get started. Create a brand new database. In my demo database over there, I'll first get started creating a store procedure. And the only thing the store procedure does is it creates two tables. So let's go ahead and create them. Two new tables, a list of customers. I just have three customers in there. A bunch of orders. Every customer made one order. And notice that in the table that I created, I have a foreign key relationship from orders into customers. So as a developer, we then think, OK, if I'm fetching data from this, I can be sure that every order I get back will also have a corresponding customer. So let's now imagine that we are writing some ADA.NET code or whatever, where we are copying those two tables into, for instance, a data set in .NET. Okay? So we could do that with selecting from the first, selecting from the second. But imagine this select takes quite a while. Imagine that you have many customers, or there was a lock on the database or whatever. Then it might be that this query takes some time. Now, my database is very quiet over here, so I mimic this with a wait for a delay statement. That just puts my SQL to sleep for 10 seconds. Okay, so I'm reading my customers. I sleep 10 seconds. I'm reading my orders. And in the meantime, somebody else sneaks in and goes ahead and runs this statement that adds customer number 4 and an order for customer number 4. By the time we get back our results over here in .NET, we see that we have 3 customers, no customer number 4, but we do have an order for our customer number 4. So then your .NET application runs into problems because we have an order for a non-existing customer. So this is because we're not running in a transaction. We're not running isolated. So many people say, yeah, let's throw it in a transaction and then we're safe. Well, let's go and have a look. Let's now throw these things into a transaction. So first, with this statement, I reset my data to the original data again. I now start the transaction. I'll sneak in again and insert the new records. And by the time that my code returns, we will see that we were not protected at all. So a transaction, well, it can give you isolation, but by default, it doesn't. So what is happening behind the scene? What was happening was this. We were bumping into the problem that when it comes to isolation in transactions, you basically have 5 different levels in there. And SQL Server by default picks a level that doesn't give you too much isolation. It's called the read-committed isolation level. And the only thing it guarantees is that if you select data, if you see data, it's data that has been committed by the transaction that placed it in there. That's the only guarantee you have. So in this case, misconception number 1, transactions protect me against operations that are happening in concurrent operations, is not true. Not if you run by the default settings. What was happening behind the scene is this. When I was doing my select, a lock was protecting me. Those rows could not be changed by anybody else. But as soon as I was finished reading, the lock is released. So after that, and before my select from order started, a new transaction could sneak in, insert the 2 new records, and continue. So then we got the first 3 old customers, and we got the 4 new orders. So that's a problem. How can we see this? Well, one thing is you can read books online from end to end, and then after a few years you know everything, if you can remember everything in there. But in reality, it's often more easy to go ahead and simply inspect what is happening on the database. And, well, most administrators are already familiar with this. I don't know how it goes with the developers, but I'm a really big fan of these dynamic management views. For most of the things that I'm going to show you, there is a built-in GUI in Management Studio that can show you these things. But that's only fine if you want to focus on one single object. If you want to see for all your objects in your database what is happening, then you need to go ahead and use these dynamic management views. Basically, what they do is they give you the option to inspect the state of your SQL Server. In this case, with sysdmtranlock, we can go ahead and see who has taken which locks. I'll do a demo in a minute. So we now know the problem. A transaction doesn't give you all the isolation you maybe need. So how can we change this? Well, you can guess, since there are 5 isolation levels, you can maybe switch to a more severe, to a more strong isolation level. For instance, there is something called repeatable read, and it guarantees that if you read the same record twice in a transaction, it will have twice the same value. That wouldn't help us, because I didn't read my orders before my customers. So we need to switch to an even more severe isolation level called serializable. And there you're protected from what is called phantom reads. Everybody awake now? Yeah, okay. Maybe I'll need to put it a bit further away. No? Okay. So with serializable, you're protected from phantom reads. Phantom reads mean that you are reading rows which didn't exist when your transaction got started. So we can switch to that serializable isolation level, and the problem is solved. But remember, there is always a price to pay. If you want more isolation, you will get less performance. If you want more performance, you need to have less isolation. So it's a matter of balancing. There is no such thing as a free lunch, not on SQL Server either. Any choice you make to improve certain things will, of course, slow down other things. And to solve that, in 2005, they added a 5th isolation level called snapshot. With the snapshot isolation level, you can get more or less the same effects as you have with the serializable isolation level, but without extra locks. But there we will go ahead and use extra disk storage. an extra CPU time at query time. There is always a price to pay. So what does that serializable isolation level do? Well, very simple. When you're reading from a table, like my customer's table over here, it will take a look. A look not only on that table, but on the whole range of rows that you are accessing, that you are addressing with that select statement. So in our case, since we don't have a where clause, it will lock all rows, everything that would meet a select statement without a where clause. And it will keep the lock not only for the duration of the select statement, but till the end of the transaction. So because of that, we're sure nobody can touch that customer table after we read it and before our transaction is finished. That's the good news. The bad news is it strongly reduces concurrency. Nobody can do anything in parallel anymore on that table. So that's the price that we pay. And a solution for that might be the snapshot isolation level. Added new in 2005, this thing does versioning. If you want to access some resources, instead of locking it and making sure nobody can touch it, we'll simply make a copy of it. You can make a change, but it's a change to your local copy. And we store that other copy until nobody ever needs the old copy again. So if you switch to that snapshot isolation level, what would happen is this. Imagine, again, I start a transaction. I read from a particular record. The value is 10. Then some transaction comes in and tries to update the record to 20. Well, if this thing is running in snapshot isolation level, it will be able to do so, but we will store two versions. The old record with the 10 in there and a new record with the 20 in there. And that new record with the 20 in there, well, in reality, the old one with the 10 in there, is stored in tempdb. So every time that you now have a transaction that wants to read from that record, it needs to figure out whether it should read in your original database or in your tempdb. So reading becomes slower because it needs to do all these checks. Plus, the size of your tempdb database goes up. There is always a price to pay. But what you would get in this case is a transaction that reads from R and that started before the commit that we have over here will see the old value. But a transaction that starts later than this commit will see the new version. We have two versions, maybe 2, 3, 4, maybe 25. It depends. If you have long-running transactions, you might have a lot of these copies over there. Okay, so let's have a quick look on how we can go and do these type of things. So let's go ahead and reset our database. Voila. Over here, if I would start a regular transaction in the default isolation level, and I read from customers, and I now check with my dynamic management view over there, you will see that the only type of locks that you have are locks at the database level. Don't panic. Doesn't mean that he locked everything in your database. It simply means that he is connected to your database. And he wants to make sure that nobody can delete the database while you're connected. That's why a drop database fails if there is at least one connection on it. That's why you cannot restore a database if there is at least one connection on it. This lock is preventing you. But besides that, there is no lock on the rows. So my select over here, my select from customers, didn't lock anything while it's finished reading. That was my problem. So let's go ahead and try to solve that problem. Let's switch to a stronger isolation level. If I now switch to that serializable isolation level over there, and I start the same transaction and I read from the same customer table, then if I now go and run that query again, by the way, over here I join a few other tables to make it a bit better readable, then you will now see that there are locks in here. For instance, over here, I see these range locks where he locked a bunch of rows in my table. And because of that, I will now be sure that nobody can modify it. Let's go and have a quick look at this. Let's go and run this transaction again. In the meantime, try to sneak in over here and insert those rows. You see this query is being blocked. Doesn't do anything because it has to wait till this statement over here is finished. So you see reduced concurrency, but because of that, you get the right results. There is always a price to pay. Okay, so that was the serializable isolation level. Again, there is another way as well, and that is that snapshot isolation level. But before you can use that, your database needs to approve this. Because your database the storage cost on your database will go up because it needs to store all these versions. So first, the administrator needs to approve that you're allowed to use this snapshot stuff. But if it does, we can now go ahead, switch to the snapshot isolation level in there, read again my customers and my orders table, like I did a couple of times. Did I reset my tables? Let's make sure. Okay, so let's go ahead, start this transaction over here, sneak in again over here, run this code, and now we see we were not blocked over here. Hip, hip, hooray. And over here, we will get consistent results. Voila, there they are. So now we have consistent results, we have no blocking, and we have larger TemDB and slower selects. That's the choice we made. Okay. So first thing to remember, transactions don't necessarily give you the isolation that you need. You might need to pick a more severe isolation level. And a brief topic that I want to add to that, that some developers bump into as well, is the story of nested transactions. If you look into books online, it states that nested transactions are supported but are not advised to be used. Why is that? Let's show you as well. So the idea of a nested transaction is very simple. Somebody somewhere already started the transaction, and now you run some store procedure or some other code in between that also wants to run things in a transaction. Okay, let's go ahead and have a look. So let's switch to this thing and kill the other ones. Voila. So back into my demo database, I simply create a product table, nothing special. A store procedure that adds a product to this, only in here I admit this is some dirty coding. What I did over here is I started the transaction, insert a record, and if the record doesn't meet all the criteria, over here for instance I only allow odd product IDs and not even product IDs, I do a rollback. In reality, it would be better to test this up front, etc. But for the sake of the example, let's go ahead and imagine we want to go and work with this store procedure. Okay. So then I can go ahead and run this store procedure. It works fine. I try to insert four products. And then if we select, we will see that from those four products, just two of them are inserted. The only ones with odd numbers, even ones are kicked out. Perfect. Fine. But now somebody wants to use my store procedure, and they run it within a transaction that they started themselves. Maybe an outer application that already runs within a transaction scope or something like that. Okay, let's go ahead, run it, and then we get something weird. Then we get an error where it says the commit transaction request has no corresponding begin transaction. And even maybe more bizarre, if we do a select star from products, where we would expect our number 5 is accepted over there, it's not. It's rejected. What is happening? Well, what is happening is this. If you go ahead and start a transaction within another transaction, and you commit that inner transaction, everything is fine. Everything is as you expect. Your inner transaction is committed. The outer one is not yet committed. Would you roll back this one, then everything is undone. That's quite logical. But if you do a rollback, if you do a rollback on this one, the problem is it doesn't roll back only the inner transaction, but it rolls back all the transactions that were open at that time. So also all the things that were made in that operation T1. In short, my rollback statement in my small store procedure could roll back a huge transaction that was started elsewhere. So how can we be safe? How can we be sure we're not ruining somebody else's transaction? And the answer is with add trend count. With add trend count, you can check how many transactions are already nested in each other. If you do a select add trend count, and you have a transaction within another one, he will tell you you have two open transactions. So what if there is already a transaction open? Don't start a new one. If your store procedure wants to roll back everything that the store procedure did and nothing else, and there is already a transaction open, it should go ahead and place a sort of marker in that transaction, which we call that a save point. And then you can go ahead and if something goes wrong in your small transaction over there, just roll back to the save point, to the marker we had over there. If there was not a transaction already running, then go ahead and roll back the transaction that you explicitly start and do a commit if you succeed, like you would program it originally. So again, let's have a look on this. Let's change my store procedure over here. So my store procedure that add a product should now do this. As soon as we start, we first check how many transactions are open. If there were already transactions open, then I'll put a save point over here. If there were no transactions open, then I'll start one myself. We do all the operations that need to be done. And then if we bump into our error scenario where we want to undo our changes, we have to check again whether we were the one that started the transaction. And in that case, we can go ahead and do a traditional rollback like you would program normally. But if we didn't start it, then we should go back to that save point that we made. I named it added. So then he will undo all the changes to that save point. If there was no error, then we do a traditional commit if we started the transaction. If we didn't start the transaction, we do nothing because the outer one will decide to commit a rollback. So let's go ahead and change my store procedure in that way. Voila. And let's now try again to add these two products. And then we will see we don't get an error. We nicely placed save points on this. The save point for the number 6 did a rollback. The save point on the number 5 didn't do a rollback. So if we now check in here, we have our product number 5 in there. So that's a second mistake that people sometimes make. A transaction within a transaction doesn't react like a single transaction would. You have to remember the save points. Okay, let's move on to the next topic. Next topic is about error handling. Since 2005, we now have try-catch blocks. And since most of you are developers, you probably know how handy it is to use a try-catch block. In the good old days, we could write a piece of code, and then we had to check our return code to see whether it was an error or not, and respond to it. So basically, the odd lines in your code were the things you had to do, and the even lines were the code that responded to errors. Since try-catch blocks, we can now separate the regular code from the error handling code, also in SQL Server. So try-catch blocks are really a good thing, but you have to worry about it again, because they don't always behave as expected. Let's maybe go into another demo on this one. Okay. So over here, let's again use our demo database. I go ahead and I create a table, which will not be relevant for the first couple of operations. Basically, what I do is a traditional customer table with a customer ID and a customer name. And then I create some index on it. I'll come back to that index in a minute when I start using it. So maybe for those of you not that familiar with the try-catch construction, maybe first a regular use. I threw in a few print statements so that we can easily see what is happening. We first say we get started. Then we come into the try block, syntax begin try. We run a regular statement that should succeed. Then I print that I'm at the end of the try, and try begin catch. You cannot throw anything between those two statements. They have to be back to back. And then I'll print that I'm in the catch block. I end my catch block and I end my code. Okay. If we go ahead and run this, you get more or less the same as what you would get in some .NET code. We start our code. We reach the try block. We then execute our statement. We reach the end try block. We jump over the catch block because nothing went wrong. And then we reach the end of the code. Okay, no problem. If you would have a traditional problem, in this case, I forced an error by dividing 1 by 0, then again, you have more or less what you expect. No result. He started to select, so because of that, he returns a table, but there are no rows in there because he bumped into an error over here. So we start our code, we have our try block, we bump into this one, we don't reach the end try, but instead of that, jump into the catch block, then we end our code and no error messages are sent back. Maybe a brief warning on this, don't catch errors if you don't know what to do with them. Same like in .NET. It's not because something can go wrong that you have to throw it in a try-catch block. If you cannot deal with the error, just leave it and pass it on to the application that was calling this. Maybe that one knows how to solve it. Okay, so that was nothing special. But now, whoops. Let's get started first with this one. Whoops. Select star from a non-existing table. Okay, we get started on this one. Start of code. We start our try block. And then when we bump into this one, we get an error. If this would be into your radio.net application, you would get a SQL exception. So even if your store procedure or whatever is using a try-catch block, you're not sure you will not get a SQL exception. In this case, he go ahead and complains that he doesn't know that table. So instead of jumping to that catch block, this thing simply stopped your code. I'll explain in a minute why. But let's first show you a few other ones. This one is even a bit more bizarre. I had a syntax error in this one. I typed select instead of select. So if you go ahead and do this, he doesn't even start the code. The reason is this. If you add a batch to SQL Server, SQL Server will go ahead and compile the whole lot at once. So if there is somewhere a syntax error in your batch, he doesn't even start the batch and immediately throws an error. So he cannot reach the catch block because he even didn't execute the try. Okay. Let's now go and look at that index that I made over there. I'll be talking about indexes a little bit further on as well. But over here, I created a non-clustered index with ignore duplicate key on. That doesn't mean that you can insert duplicates. It simply means that if you insert a duplicate in that particular table, he will not consider it an error, but he will consider it a warning. And he will silently ignore your row. This is simply one of the types of warnings that you can have. So let's go ahead and try this thing. So I insert twice a customer with a value 42, where 42 is the thing on which, well, the ID, sorry, is the thing on which I have my non-clustered index. Okay, let's run it. And now we see something else. We start our code, we start our try block, then over here I get my warning, in black, not in red, because it's not an error. And then he simply reaches the end of the try block and he doesn't jump to the catch block because warnings are not severe enough to throw into the catch block. So warnings simply continue the code as if nothing happened. And let's then maybe go and try to mimic the last one, the one that you definitely don't want to have. In SQL Server, errors can have certain severities. A severity less than, well, 10 or less than 10 means it's just a warning. If an error is more severe than 19, though, it means that it's a fatal error. And fatal errors simply close down your connection. Normally, you only get fatal errors if you have problems with, memory, not enough memory available, and these type of severe things, not regular application errors. But you can force them if you want, because with the raise error statement, you can throw your own errors. And if you consider this thing to be severe, with my severity of 23, it will kill my connection. Okay, let's go ahead. Run this, start of the code, start of the try block, and then we bump into the raise error, and that thing kills my connection. As he says over here, a severe error occurred. The results, if any, should be discarded. SQL Server is terminating this process. So the code dies before we reach the catch block. Okay. So what did we saw? We saw that you cannot be sure on a try-catch block. Try-catch blocks will not catch all problems that you can have in your T-SQL. In fact, they don't catch warnings. So if the severity of your error is less than 11, it simply continues and doesn't go into the catch block at all. If your severity is more than 19, it's a very severe error, and it kills your connection, so it cannot go into the catch block at all. If you have a syntax error, it doesn't start your code. And if you have a late binding error, with that I mean you do a select, for instance, from a table that doesn't exist. He only checks that at the moment he starts running your select statement, then notice that the table doesn't exist, and consider it a sort of syntax error that only occurs at the point in time where you want to do your select. So these type of late binding errors also don't jump into your catch block. And then there is another type of problem that can occur, that is in your catch code, and the code in the catch block, you can write an error as well. So then you get an error in the catch block, and that needs to be catched somewhere as well. So what can we do about it? How can we solve it? Well, for certain things, it's not easy to solve. For instance, the problem with the warnings that we have is nearly impossible to solve unless you can detect the warning. If you can detect somewhere in your code that something went wrong, you can raise an error yourself. Oh, we saw the raise error statement a few minutes ago. If you notice a problem, raise something with a severity more than 10, then it will get caught. If you have these very severe problems, that out-of-memory problem and all these type of things related to that, so if the severity is more than 20, the only solution is, in SQL Agent, you can define something which is called an alert. So talk with your administrator, configure an alert. An alert can respond to an entry in the Windows application log, and in that way you can write a job that will respond to this thing. But for late binding errors, it's easier to solve. There we as developers can solve it, because you can have a catch block in a catch block. Just like I had my transactions in a transaction, you can have a catch block in a catch block. And if you have a late binding error, he skips your catch block at your level, but the error can be caught in a surrounding try-catch block. And the same thing goes for errors, mistakes that you would have in your catch code as well. So let's maybe briefly show that, and then I'll come back to a very special case. Let's mix my transactions that I had a few minutes ago with this exception handling stuff that we are having over here. Okay, first a brief demo to show you how you can solve the late binding problem. So over here I made a store procedure. That store procedure does whatever we did a few minutes ago. We start, we select from a non-existing table. We have a catch block over here, which we will never reach. We now know this. So if I go ahead and execute this store procedure without anything else, we get the error. But if I now start the store procedure in a surrounding try-catch block, then we will see that over here on my messages, I do get the message that I'm in the outer catch block. In other words, we reached this part over here because I have an outer catch block. And in the catch block, might be handy to know as well, that you have a bunch of functions in there. Functions like error number, error message, error line, error severity, etc., which tell you about the error that caused you to jump to the catch block. So in my case, I do a select of the two of them and get over here a table that says that in my inner try catch block, I got error 208, invalid object name, non-existing table. But let's see. Okay. We can do something else as well. We can go and combine the story that we had not that long ago, the story of transactions, with the story of exception handling. So for that, I start a new story. I create a new table, and in there, nothing special, a column ID, which is a primary key. So we cannot have duplicates. We cannot have null values. And a quantity on which I don't care what's in there. I start the transaction. And in the transaction, I insert two records, both with a value of 42 for the ID, a 1 and a 2 for the quantity over there. Sure, this will bump into an error. But let's maybe go and have a small quiz on this. How many rows do you think will be in that table after we ran the two insert statements? We start with an empty table, so the minimum is 0, the maximum is 2. Let's go and have a vote on this. Who thinks that in the end, in this table, we will have one row? 1, 2, 3, 4, yeah, about 10%. Who believes we will have two rows? Nobody goes for the two rows. Okay, you have some trust in the primary key. Who then believes that we will have zero rows? Okay, majority goes for zero rows. Let's see what the democracy does on SQL Server. Okay, we insert it, we bump into the error that we would expect, and then you get one row. So why is this? You bump into a transaction. That transaction bumps into a problem over here, but that problem is not severe enough to cause it to do a rollback. It has a commit. So this thing gets committed. The error we got, if you look into our messages, again, let's maybe truncate the table quickly to show you. Truncate table test key. Voila. So So if you go ahead and do the insert again, you see that you get an error because of the violation, cannot insert duplicates, but he doesn't tell you that he rolled back the transaction. So he did a commit. Now, how can we solve that problem? Well, to solve that problem, oh, here was already a truncate. Let's go ahead and use it again. To solve that problem, there is a setting called transact abort, which by default is turned off. So I was running with the default behavior over here. And if it's turned off, then if you have this type of errors, they're not severe enough to cause your transaction to be rolled back. But you can turn the option on. And then we get what the majority of the voters in this country want. So again, I get an error on this. But now, if you do a select, there are zero rows in your table. So with transact abort on, these type of things will really roll back your transaction. But what then if you have a try-catch block? So let's go ahead and see, in my catch block, will he automatically roll back the transaction? We can test that easily by selecting again add a trend count. So if I go ahead and run this thing, as soon as I reach my catch block, trend count equals 1. So my transaction is still open when I'm in the catch block. That's good news, because it means that you in your catch block can inspect what was happening. You can see which rows were already inserted and which were not, and how many rows and whatever. But a mistake that many people make is this. They over here will insert then a record into some audit table. They will write in there, oh, we have a problem, so many rows were inserted, etc. And then after a few weeks, they're happy because their audit table remains empty. Of course it remains empty. You insert over here, but you don't explicitly roll back your transaction, so the end catch will roll back the transaction. And your insert in the audit table happened in the transaction, and it's because of that rollback as well. So you have an empty audit table, but you do have errors. So you need to make sure in your catch block that you do have transactions open or not, and roll them back before you do stuff like this. So how can we do that? Well, with another function. You have transact state. With transact state, you can check in your catch block whether a transaction is open or not. If exact state equals 0, it means you don't have a transaction open, you don't need to worry. But if transact state is -1, then a transaction is open, but this transaction is called uncommittable. But in the betas, they have a nice name for this, they call that doomed. A doomed transaction is doomed to die. You cannot commit it, but it's still alive. So it's still open. If you have a transaction with exact state -1, you have to call a rollback on this. You cannot commit it. If the transact state is 1, then it means that your transaction can be committed if you want. And it's up to you to choose whether you want to commit it and save what was already done, or not committed. If I would not run with exact abort on, if I would run with transact abort off, this transaction would be committable, would be having a transact state of 1. But with transact abort on, he changed the transact state to -1. My transaction is doomed and will be rolled back. So then, after my rollback, I can write to another table. So let's go ahead and select this stuff, run it over here. So now he prints out doomed, and my rows are rolled back. So if I select from test key, they should be empty. Voila. So that was the problem of the try-catch blocks. So remember, try-catch blocks don't catch everything you hope for. And with transactions, please worry about the doomed transactions and how to solve them. Okay. Topic number 3, a lot of debate on this one, store procedures. Store procedures versus ad hoc SQL code. A lot of debate on that lately. You have on one hand people who believe that everything that has to do with your database should be in the database. So please put the business logic in the database in a store procedure, especially if the administrator of the SQL server is responsible for performance. He wants to have some control on this, and then he really enjoys that it is in the database. Other people are believers of the object relational mappers. the entity framework and whatever tools you have over there. And they don't like to have the logic in the database, but they want to have the logic in the application. So there is so much debate on this and so few emergency exits over here that I don't want to start a discussion over here. Maybe not everybody will can get out when the fight starts. So because of that, I just want to stick to the statement over here that I believe that you do need an abstraction layer. And to me, that can be an object relational mapper, that can be a stored procedure. Both options are possible. But what I notice is that many people believe that stored procedures have all sorts of properties that would make them special or better than what an object relational mapper can do. And there are some surprises in it as well. So let's go ahead and look at stored procedures from a performance point of view. The previous topics were about correctness of your code. Now it's more about performance. Okay, new demo, stored procedures. And what I want to do over here is this. I want to create a table with 1 million rows in it. I have this code in here to create that table. If you download the code, please run that one. But it would take too long to wait on that one over here. It probably takes 1 or 2 minutes. Oh, no, don't close that one. Close all but this. No, no. Voila. So what I did was I made the database before, and I just took a backup of the database. So I'll go ahead and restore that one. I have a table in there which has an ID, an amount, and a country ID. So people sell something via reseller. We store the reseller ID, the amount of the sales transaction, and the country in which it was sold. And we have a bit of a special situation. We have 999,999 sales from country number one, and we have one sales transaction from country number 11. Okay. Then I made a non-clustered index. Indexes are the next topic, so don't worry if you're not into indexes yet. I'll talk a little bit about those as well. I made an index on country ID because I want to run some queries on country ID. If you do timings as a developer, you have to worry about caching and stuff like that. If you run two queries and the second query is faster, might be because you wrote it better, or it might be because you had some cached data in there. So I will run these statements. The checkpoint statement flushes all my dirty pages. Drop clean buffers cleans the cached data. DBCC free procache cached drops the cached execution plans. So after that, your server is as slow as if you had a cold start. Don't do this on your production server. But on development, no problem. Okay. Then I'll go ahead and I'll do a count. I'll fetch a count of the number of records we have in countries between 10 and 15. I should only have one country in there. So let's go ahead. What did happen? Oh, yes, I'm in the master database. Of course, it's not in there. So let's go ahead and switch to my demo database. Okay. So clean everything. Then count the number of records that I have in there. Voila. Take some time because it needs to create a statistic. What's a statistic? Well, wait another 10 minutes and we will talk about those as well. But first I want to show you that the time necessary to run this query is nearly 0 milliseconds. It's very, very quickly because there is only one row in there and he can quickly find that row because he has an index on country ID. Let's count the number of countries in the other group of, the number of records in the other group of countries. We have a lot of them in there. And then over here we see that it took 218 milliseconds. Please try to remember 218 milliseconds, roughly, 220, let's say. Because now I want to do things with the holy cow of many developers. I want to use a stored procedure to run exactly the same query. Let's imagine this is not a parameter, it's built in. Doesn't really matter, you can make it a parameter as well if you want. But the countries, those are definitely parameters of my stored procedure. Okay. Create the stored procedure. We clean our cache to have a fair comparison. We fetch those in the low number of countries. And we very quickly get a result. So this is as fast as my original query was. Now I go ahead and fetch the other ones. You don't even need to look at the timings. You can see from this that it took a while. If you look into the messages, it's not, what was it, 220 milliseconds. it's now 1,450 milliseconds. So that's a factor 7, 8 slower. So where is the performance of my store procedure? Weren't store procedures faster than regular code? What happened? Well, to see what happened, we need to go ahead and look into the way that your execution plans are being stored. So when you create a store procedure, and when you run your store procedure, it behaves a little bit different than ad hoc code, as we saw. And sometimes it runs better. I will tell you, in most cases, it's not doing that bad. But with this demo, I want to show you that it's not always better. In fact, it can sometimes be worse. So we need to look at the internals of what is happening over here before we can really answer the question why my store procedure was slower and how we can solve it. So what really happens is this. If you have some code, some select statement or whatever, and you run this on your SQL Server first need to parse the query. Do these tables exist? Is the syntax okay? Are you joining? That kind of stuff. After he parsed your query, he then looks up in something in memory, the procedure cache, whether that query was already run before. And if it was, he takes from memory how that query was executed. If it was not yet run, then he will go ahead and build a new execution plan for that and store that in memory. And next time, he goes ahead and uses that one. Okay. And then as soon as he has his execution plan, he can start executing the query. Where can we inspect? Well, in two places. One thing you can do is you can check the memory again with the dynamic management view. So you can see all the execution plans that are waiting in your memory on reuse. Or with the profiler, you can inspect the operation, the process of a check over here, whether the execution plan exists or not. Then you get a cache hit or a cache miss event. And if he builds a new one and inserts it, you have a cache insert event. So you can monitor the state as well as the process. Let's go ahead and do this. Another demo. So here is this dynamic management view, DM exec cached plans. It will go ahead and show me a lot of things in here. So he tells you compiled plans, parse trees, etc. You get some cryptic plan handle over here. So with a few extra statements, I can make something better out of this. This query now shows me my cached plans and the statements from which they came. Aha. So let's now do some experiment. Let's clean the cache. If I clean the cache and I then run this query again, the only statements in there are the statements that I'm running. So that function that I called over there, that view that I call over here, and my select statement, those are the only things in memory. Okay? Let's now create a store procedure. Doesn't really matter what it does. We create a store procedure. And let's check again. Nothing. If you create a store procedure, many people believe that your store procedure is immediately compiled. Well, it's called a stored procedure. The only thing he does with it is he stores it, but he doesn't compile it. So you can easily check this. Go ahead and create a stored procedure where you take from this cryptical table that doesn't exist at all. Let's go ahead, create it. Oh, yes, there's, of course, one already with that name. So let's create another one. No complaint whatsoever. He doesn't check whether those things exist. He just stores whatever you typed. So it's only when we go ahead and run the store procedure that he will go ahead and create the execution plan. Voila. If we now check again, we will see in here my store procedure statement. And in fact, this view tells me that it has been used 3 times. So if you run 3 queries with different parameters over there, he goes ahead and reuses the execution plan. That's good news. So let's go ahead, reset our cache, and do the same thing. This is the query that was in my store procedure over there. So let's go and run the query 3 times with different values in there. Let's then check again in our cache, and then we will see that each of them got a new execution plan. He didn't reuse them. He created 3 brand new execution plans for this. So that means for the camp that was in favor of having something like an object relational mapper, that if your object relational mapper is sending this type of queries to the database, you have a problem. Because if you run the same query again with 200 different parameters, you have 200 of these execution plans, and as you see, they're not that cheap on memory. Okay, 24K is not a lot, but if you have thousands and thousands of copies of that, your memory will fill up with them. But most object relational mappers don't do it like this. They use SP execute SQL. So let's see how that one behaves. With SP execute SQL, we now run again three times the same code, ad hoc code, not my stored procedure, with different parameters. Then we check again our execution plans, and now we do see over here that he did reuse this general query three times. So he made one execution plan and reused it. In short, let's maybe go and have a look at my slides again. So what happened? Misconception number one, stored procedures are compiled at creation time. They're not, they're just stored. They get compiled on their first use. Okay. The compiled plan is stored in memory, never on disk. Okay? Misconception number two, stored procedures have better performance than ad hoc code. My initial demo already showed you that that is not the case. The only advantage that they have is that they reuse their execution plan, but so does regular code if you execute it with SP execute SQL. That's why your radio.net is calling things that way. So, in short, stored procedures don't offer anything special. They don't offer any advantages that we cannot have with SP execute SQL. The only advantage they have is that you don't need to send your code from the client to the server. That's already stored at the server. So that can save you a few bytes on your network communication between client and server. But from a performance point of view, that's the only advantage they have. That doesn't mean they're not useful. They can be used for security reasons, etc., but definitely not for performance. So stored procedures reuse their execution plans when possible. Usually this is a good thing, but it can be a bad thing. What was happening with my original demo over there? Why was the stored procedure so slow? Because I first ran it with a very small country. So he picked an execution method that was great if you only have a few number of rows to return. He used that one all the time, also when I asked him to return 1 million rows. So sometimes reuse of execution plans is bad. And that's why you should not write stored procedures which are 10 pages large. Try to keep your stored procedures small, not only from a good development practice, it's easier to read, it's easier to maintain, etc., but also from a performance point of view. If you build a huge stored procedure, the first time that it runs, for the state, for the current state of the execution of the stored procedure, for your parameters, he will go ahead and build one large execution plan. The likelihood that that will be useful in other contexts is much smaller than if you have many small stored procedures that get called. Okay, let's see how much time I have left. 20 minutes, so I'll need to be a bit more brief on this. You can solve it in a few ways. One way is, if you run a stored procedure, you can go ahead and tell that stored procedure to not store its execution plan. If you do an exec of a stored procedure, in this case with special parameters, you can say with recompile. So please build an execution plan for this, and after my query is finished, throw it away. Don't store it in memory. If I would now go ahead and run my two calls over here, you will see that he goes ahead and only uses one of them. So here in my create proc, there is only one use count. He made a new one for this and stored that one, but he skipped this one. He ran the query with an ad hoc execution plan and threw it away, because with the recompile you told him, this is an exceptional execution, it's not a regular case, don't store this execution plan. There are other ways as well. A quite drastic way is with recompile. Every time this stored procedure executes, build a new execution plan for the parameters you have over here. Never reuse an execution plan. Then your stored procedure is as slow as if you were running ad hoc code without execute SQL. A last option, and that's probably the preferable way, is this one. You can create your stored procedure with an option in there. with a query hint where you say, optimize this code for these values of the store procedures. So I don't care which is the first execution of the store procedure. Always build the execution plan as if you were feeding in these values and store those. So if I now go ahead and build my store procedure that way, and I go ahead, and I go ahead and run it twice, he will go ahead and use twice that same execution plan, but he made the execution plan as if you called it every time with these parameters. So we see we get different results, but if we inspect, we will see two reuses of the execution plan. The first query is now not that optimal, but the second one is. Okay, so 20 minutes to go, two topics to cover. Let's go and move into the next one. And that is related to what I was showing over here, indexes. Most of you are already a bit familiar with indexes, but for those not that familiar with indexes in SQL Server, we have two sorts of indexes in SQL Server. One type is called a clustered index, and it looks a little bit like a telephone book. All the data is sorted. There is no difference between the index and the data. The index is the data. This is an index on city, within that on last name, within city and last name on first name. Regular books don't work that way. Regular books store their data in a logical way, and at the back, they have an index. That index is what we call in SQL Server a non-clustered index. So that non-clustered index can be handy because you can now have your data sorted in one way, but if you need to look up something, you look it up in the index and find the pointer to the data. So these indexes can speed up your queries, but not all of them. So let's show that as well. Okay, so back into my demos database over there. And now I'm going to have a look on how he runs a query. And with setStatistics.io on, you can ask for every query that is sent on your SQL Server how many pages, how many blocks of data he needs to read. A page is 8K of data. So let's go ahead and over here go back into my amount table, where I only need to fetch IDs between 1,000 and 1,002. There are only three rows in there, but if you look into your messages, you will see that he has to read 3,247 blocks of data to answer that question. If I would go and read the whole table, it takes a lot longer, of course. It's much more data. It's 1 million rows that need to be returned. But we will see when it gets back that it takes exactly the same amount of memory access or disk access to go ahead and run this one. So whether you need two rows or all rows, it takes the same amount of effort from a memory or disk point of view. So why is this? Well, because I don't have the right index. That's clear. I'm filtering on ID. So then if you have an index on ID, you can speed up that filtering. So let's go and create one. Again, a few queries with sys.indexes. You get a list of all the indexes that you have. If you throw them together with a few more tables, you can get a nice list of all the indexes and how they are built. For instance, this is not an index. This is a heap. This is what you get in SQL Server if you don't have an index. But let's go ahead and build an index. So I build an index on ID, and then we should do better. So let's give it a try as well. With Control M, you can show the execution plan. If you do a Control M or you go in here, query, and then include actual execution plan, if you run a query, you can see how SQL Server is running that query. And now we see over here for my query that he is using that non-clustered index. So need to zoom in a little bit, but over here you find the name of the index that he's using. So he did use the index that I created a few minutes ago. Okay, I'm happy. My query is using the index. And if you look on the I/O, you now see that instead of reading, what was it, 2,000-3,000 pages, I'm down to 6 pages. So this query is now a factor 300-400 faster than it was a few minutes ago. Okay, that's good. So let's fetch a few more tables from this. Okay, still using my index. Let's go and fetch 5,000 records. And now he's not using my index. I made an index for him. I'm searching on ID, and he refuses to use my index. This is what makes a lot of developers angry. We did the effort of building an index, and he refuses to use it. Some people go as far as using a query hint to force him to use the index. If we query a little bit more, we will see that with 2,690, he's not using my index. With 2,680, he is using my index. So somewhere there is a borderline where he starts and stops using the index. Why is this? Well, the answer is relatively simple. If you think back of my books over here, my telephone book and my other, especially the other one, imagine that I give you something to read. I say, okay, go ahead and look into this book on the topic of indexes. Well, I zoomed in into the table of content over here. So for indexes, you have a few page numbers to read. Imagine that this book would be 300 pages, and I gave you a topic over here where I enlisted 700 numbers. Read page 1, read page 3, then page 1 again, then page 5, then page 1 again, then... You would not go and do this. You would start to read the book from front to end. That would be a lot faster than going into each of those pages and jump back and forward all the time. SQL Server is doing the same thing. So a non-clustered index doesn't contain the sales amount in our case, only the ID. So if he finds an ID in the non-clustered index, he needs to jump back into the heap to find the amount. And if he needs to jump back a few hundred times, it's still faster to do so. But if he needs to jump back thousands of times, it's slower than reading the whole thing. So if you get more references to pages than there are pages in the book, it's easier to read the whole book. If there are more pages in your object, then there are, if there are more pointers to your heap than you have pages in your heap, then it's easier to forget about the non-clustered index. So non-clustered indexes are only useful if you have either a highly selective query, a query that returns less rows than you have pages in your object. To be honest, it's even a factor two. If you have half the number of rows than the number of pages in your object, then he will go ahead and use the non-clustered index. If you have more than half of them, in most cases, he will not use it. So that's one case. Non-clustered indexes are only useful if you return a small number of rows or if all the data that you are looking for is in the non-clustered index. Go and look into books online in the topic of covering a query with a non-clustered index. There you'll find more information on this. So how can we go ahead and look at this? Again, a bunch of dynamic management views. I already showed you some of them. How can we solve it? In certain cases, you can't. If you need to retrieve nearly all the columns in your table and nearly all the rows, a non-clustered index cannot help you out. It can only be useful if you need to return a small number of rows or a small number of columns. Remember that they always told you, always write a where clause, never do a select star. Well, this is one of the reasons why. If you do a select star and all columns are in there, non-clustered indexes are useless. If you don't have a where clause and you need to return all rows, non-clustered indexes are useless. You cannot go and use them to speed up your queries. A few exceptional cases might be in there. So only if you filter on highly selective columns, you can go ahead and use non-clustered indexes, or you have a non-clustered index that has all the columns in there. So let me see how much time I have. 20 minutes, 10 minutes, sorry. Let's go into a very quick demo. So how can I find the number of pages in here? Again, a nice dynamic management view, DMDB index physical stats. It's not a view, it's a function, but if you go ahead and run this, we will see that our heap over here is 3,200 pages. So half of that is about 1,600. That was my borderline that I had over there. So maybe one last trick that I want to show you. The problem was if I was returning a lot of records over here, he did a table scan. And table scans are bad. So how can you detect table scans? Well, there is a very easy way. Let's run my query again such that I have a table scan in there. Here I have a dynamic management view that looks into those cached plans and looks up what the plan looks like. So I can check the XML. I can check the XML representation of my execution plan in memory. And with this query, I get all queries that ran in the last few days and that had a table scan in there. So if I click on this one, I can over here see the query that was causing my problem that didn't have the right index on it. And in this case, I could go ahead and quickly fix it, for instance, by creating a combined index where I have ID and sales amount in it. That one, well, in my case, nearly copies the whole table. But if you would have this one, this will always be useful because now all the data that you need to retrieve for this particular query is in that non-clustered index. Okay, so if I now pick even a large one like this one, it will go ahead and use my non-clustered index. Okay, so let's finish up with the last topic. And the last topic is a topic that many people don't worry about until they bump into problems with it. So let's show you a problem. It's statistics. We have a chicken and egg problem. What was first, the chicken or the egg? In this case, what is first? If I kick off a query, we saw from the previous demo that SQL Server needs to know how many rows will be returned. If you return many rows, don't use the non-clustered index. If you return a few rows, do use the non-clustered index. But how can we know how many rows we will get back without running the query? Chicken and egg problem. And the solution lies in statistics. What are statistics? Something that SQL Server builds automatically, and that has a sort of histogram, a distribution of your data. It goes ahead, for instance, imagine this is a sales table, and I have over here, let's say, the family name of my customer. So he then will go ahead and count how often a family name occurs over here. He has sorted them all alphabetically, so we only have a few people with A or B in it, a lot of them with C and D, then again, not too many over here, and with V, we have a lot of them again, and he stores this distribution. Not exactly. He will take at most 200 steps, 200 blocks in the histogram. So if you now kick off a query where you say, oh, show me what is between this and this customer over here, he knows that it is this whole block plus some fragment of this one and some fragment of that one. And with that, he can get an estimate. And the good news is he builds these statistics automatically and he updates them automatically. So most developers think, ah, no problem, I don't need to worry on this. Okay, let's give you a few things to worry about. Okay, statistics. Let's go in here, switch to my demos. Let's maybe go and close the other ones. Okay, so again, you can go ahead and see which statistics you have in there. In my case, I want to see all the statistics on objects that were not shipped by Microsoft. And then we see in here that for my table that I'm having over here, my reseller sales table, a bunch of statistics were being created. Okay, for instance, my non-clustered index over there created a statistic. Let's go ahead and have a look. In that statistic, you, for instance, see that the value 1 and the value 999,000 and a bit occurred in there, and that they all occurred once, and that there were 999,997 distinct values in between. This basically means it's a nice uniform distribution. There are no bumps in there. It's all flat between start and end. Great. It was created when I created the index. If you create an index, he creates statistics. Fine. So now let's go and look at his estimates. Okay, Control M. Oh, I ran these queries already before. But let's now go and show the execution plans. In your execution plans, you will see over here, for every query, the number of the actual number of rows and the estimated number of rows. These estimates are coming from your statistics. If they're close to the actual number of rows, great. But sometimes they're not. So what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to add 100,000 rows to my table. That's quite a lot, huh? Query executed successfully. That's a bit too fast. So let's see. Yeah, that's better. So I'm adding 100,000 rows in a table with 1 million rows. That's quite a lot. Will he update the statistics? That's the question. So we can go and check this out. There is a function that returns when a statistic was updated last. So it takes a little bit of time to insert 100,000 rows. But as soon as they are in there, we will go ahead, run this query, and, well, still have 4 minutes. Yeah. Why is he taking so long? Okay, there he is. So if I now go ahead and check when my statistic over here on reseller sales was last updated, you see that it's 1722. We're now 1727. So we didn't update them. So if I now go ahead and kick off a query like this, fetch me everything where the ID is larger than 1 million, and I show the actual execution plan on this one, over here, wait, what I'm doing over here, get me a count. Yes, I have that non-clustered index, of course, that he is using. So I should have dropped that non-clustered index. Let's see, yeah. So I first need to drop the non-clustered index that I made in my last demo. So over here on your tables for your reseller sales, you can go ahead, find your non-clustered indexes that we made. This is the combined index that I had. So let's delete the index. Okay. Then on your statistics, you will see that it dropped the statistic that belonged to that one as well. So if we now go ahead and run this query again, he will now go ahead and have an execution plan over here where he estimated one row, but he got 100,000 rows. He didn't update the statistics, and because of that, he's wrong on how to run this query. He goes for the non-clustered index, and he shouldn't. Because if you look at the number of pages he needs to read for this query, then you'll see that he needs to read 100,000 pages. If you read the whole table, it's a lot faster. It's only 3,000 pages. So this query is a factor 10,000 slower than if you would run the whole, if you look at the whole table. So how can we solve this? With update statistics. We can force our statistics to be updated. And this is especially important if you have columns where you only append values to the end. Identity columns, transaction dates, where all the new records are only at the end. If you update your statistics at night, and then you add at daytime 100,000 new sales orders, and you ask him in the evening what was sold today, his estimate is one record, unless you update your statistics. So statistics must be updated on things where your distribution changes quickly. Not on customer. If you have 100,000 sales entries, your distribution of family names will not change that much, but the distribution of your identity columns does. Okay, I have 1 minute, so one last demo, and that is this one. Imagine that I have a table with two columns in there, an ID and a value. A value and a name. We don't care about the ID. I throw in there a bunch of records. Okay. And what is typical on these records? Well, there is a very strong correlation between this value and that one. One always has an A, two always has a B, three always has a C, etc. Imagine, for instance, you have something like gender and first name, where there is a strong correlation as well. If I would now go ahead and kick off a query where I look for the A's and the 1's, what he will do is he will build statistics himself. He will go ahead and on this particular table, he would go ahead and build... why is this one slow again? Stop. Ooh, it's no good. So let's start from sysdates. So... anyhow, what I try to show you is that on this table, let's show it over here then, refresh, on my stats demo, he made two statistics. He doesn't want to show them. Anyhow, believe me, he made two statistics. And the problem with the statistics is, let's show the actual execution plan again, that in his estimates, he estimates that although I really have 53 records over there, he estimates only 5.3 records. Why is that? He said, well, 10% of your values are 1s, 10% of your values are A, so I guess that 1% of your values are a 1 and an A. He doesn't know there is a correlation between them. So if you have two columns in a where clause, and they are correlated like I have over here, you should go ahead and create an explicit statistic which contains the two values, because then he will store the correlation on them. And then if you would go ahead and run this query again, he now has the right estimates on this. So from this correlated query over here, you see his estimate was 52.1 row, where in reality had 53 rows. So if you have two columns strongly correlated, please build a combined statistic on them. SQL Server never builds them automatically. Okay, 2 minutes over time. My apologies. So let's wrap up. Conclusions. Conclusion number one, transactions don't give you isolation unless you explicitly do so with setting the transaction isolation level. Be careful about nested transactions. If you roll back the inner one, he rolls back the whole thing. Try catch blocks. Don't catch everything you might think they catch. Store procedures are nice, but they're not good from a performance point of view. They're as good as an execute SQL statement, not better. Might be handy for security, etc., not for anything else. Indexes, non-clustered indexes are only helpful if you return a small number of rows, less than you have pages in your object, or if you only return a small number of columns. And finally, statistics are created automatically, are updated automatically, but sometimes you need to give them a hand. That were my five misconceptions. Thank you for being here, and enjoy Tech Days.